Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 20. Today we're talking to Jeff Braun. US-based race engineer Jeff has over 40 years experience engineering at the highest level in North America. Working with both professional and amateur racers, Jeff has the full spectrum of experience. Today we talk about optimizing the setup for the driver, adapting it for different weather conditions. Should you change it or should you not? What you might find most interesting, however, is the process and approaches that Jeff adopts, not only for his racing, but in fact for everything in his life. Jeff makes his own coffee and applies exactly the same process to that as he does to his racing. It's absolutely fascinating, and I really hope that you get a lot from it. So grab a pen, grab a coffee, sit back and enjoy this really good episode. So welcome, Jeff.
Hey, good to be here. Good to be here.
I'm really excited about this. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's rare that we get someone with such pedigree to come and talk to us in a club racing environment, particularly from an engineering point of view. It'd be absolutely fascinating to hear about you a little bit more for those who don't know who you are and hear about your experiences in racing. So maybe there's one or two things that we can get as a club racer, one or two takeaways that we can weigh from this show and think, yeah, actually, that's something I didn't know before, and that will really make a difference so that people can get a takeaway and go back to their own racing and think, yeah, that is a real advantage now. So that's the gauntlet laid down. So there we go. So you're an engineer and you also make coffee as well. I tell you what, let's just do the coffee bits. So my understanding is, Jeff, that you make coffee, but because you're an engineer, you send data sheets. Tell me about the coffee, man. This is amazing.
Yeah, I guess it's what happens when an engineer gets a hobby and he can't separate the engineering from the hobby part of it. I got into coffee. I don't know exactly how. I think I like hobbies with, as you say, with kit, with, you know, machinery and things like that. I started with an espresso machine, and then I wanted to change the pressure profile and the flow rate and the extraction percentage. I bought a refractometer. I bought a things that I could measure my extraction percentage and things like that. And then I thought, rather than just buy coffee beans, I should roast my own coffee beans. So I bought a roaster and I put a data system on it so I could measure temperature versus time profiles.
But can you tell the difference? Like if we keep this in a racing analogy, is the lap time getting quicker? You know, can you tell the difference in with all this sort of science that goes into the coffee? I would assume you can, but equally, like, can you?
You can, and that's what's cool. The analogy to racing holds true. So we're trying to manipulate a setup to be what the driver wants it to be. To me, that as a race engineer, that's the main goal. You can have your simulation, you can have your data, you can have everything that you think the vehicle should do, but if the driver doesn't like it, he's not going to go quicker. And ultimately, you need to suit it to the driver so he can use it to go quicker. So that's the race engineer's job. Find a setup the driver likes. The coffee engineer's job in roasting coffee is to find a coffee that the drinker likes. And just like racing, it's different for each driver or each coffee drinker. Some people like one flavor, another like another. Some like it stronger, some like more chocolate notes, some like more fruit notes, like wine in a way. And with the roast profile, how I roast it with temperature versus time and what the curve shape is and how you hold it and how long you roast it in certain areas of as the bean is losing its humidity and starting to crack and starting to then caramelize the bean and bring out the different flavors. How you do that changes the flavor of the coffee completely. And so I'm starting to learn, if I do this with the profile, with my data trace, then I get more of a chocolatey, nutty flavor. If I do this, I get more of a fruit forward, kind of fruity, citrusy flavor. And then you can start out with different beans. You can have Colombian, Ethiopian, barley, you can start out with different beans that are able to be, to me, it's like a race car. If you soften the springs on a car, it can do something, but it'll be slightly different if you soften the springs on your track day GT car as if you soften your springs on your Indy car. And so they have the same trends, but it affects different cars or different beans differently. So then I get crazy and there's big spreadsheets of how this worked and how that worked. And I'm trying to learn how I can affect the flavor of the bean the same way as race engineering, I learn how I can affect the handling and the feel of the car. It's so much alike, and maybe I've just found a way to make it alike so that I can relate to it, but that's the way I relate to the coffee end of it. And so people started, like, I know I was giving it away just to get some feedback, just like you would from a driver. What do you think? Oh, this is good. Oh, that's terrible. And no, this is great. And so I would keep doing it. And then finally, a couple of my friends, the first guy was John Edwards, who's a factory BMW driver. He said to me, he goes, I want some more coffee, but I feel bad asking you for it for free. He said, you should sell it. And I said, I could sell it and just so I break even. And so I put a website up there. And when I have time, I can't roast all the time, but when I do, I just do some coffee, send out the data sheet and some pro tips on how to grind it and brew it and things like that, and learn and get better each time I send out some coffee to people.
I love it. I'm a real coffee fan. I just love that. I love everything about it. What you described there is a kind of a mindset. You're like, you almost couldn't help yourself do it that way, I imagine, because you're just not right. I'm putting words into your mouth, but I imagine that it feels uncomfortable to be out of control of some of these variables. And so you're putting in something and then you're getting an unknown outcome each time. So if you can control some of the process by which these beans are being roasted, that's going to give you more predictability of a successful outcome at the other end. I think treating it like a science experiment is quite similar, well, very similar to how, you know, most professional racing teams go racing. And it's something that I personally see missing quite often from the club paddock. Is that something you've seen or yourself? Yes. Or disagree with? I don't know.
For sure. To me, it's what we try to do in racing, whether we're club racing or whether we're top professional racing, is if you can predict the outcome, then you can better choose which variable you want to manipulate to get that outcome. And you get more and more experienced along the line as you play with it more and learn more. But part of that learning is you have to understand what the result, and that's where the data that you get helps, because you can quantify it, but there's also the human element, and you have to blend both of those together. And so the club racer a lot of times thinks, I need the data. Or he says, I don't need the data. I think you're better off if you can bring both of those together. To back to the coffee analogy, I need the roast profile, but I also need the person to tell me whether it tastes good. Because just because it looks good on the graph doesn't mean it's going to taste good. Just because the data says that's better doesn't mean it's actually going to handle better for that particular driver. So I see a lot of club racers get caught up a lot of times on one side or the other. It's all data. Well, the data says I pulled 0.1 more G, but why am I a half a second slower? Because you pulled 0.1 more G in a peak, but you couldn't maintain it around the corner, or the car didn't transition very well, so it was bad in this particular area. So I think people need to use both, and that's where the trick comes in, because you can't be all hardcore engineering and you can't be all just talking to the driver. And that's what's fun about it, is combining engineering with the human side of it. And to me, that's what I enjoy about race engineering, rather than just whatever, structural engineering, where you're going to design a bridge with a 10 safety factor and you're done and there's one answer. And every engineer is going to get the same answer. But when you put the human factor in, you're not going to get the same answer. And that's what is enjoyable for me.
I totally agree. And that's been my experience and pleasure personally as well. So it's lovely to to hear that from someone else, because I used to work in vehicle dynamics and we used to do suspension and steering development for road. But the nice thing was my role was very much computer-based, to be honest, but it wasn't, you know, there was no point in having the fastest car on the computer. We wanted the fastest car or the best car in reality. And it always had this subjective sign-off, which we call it a subject, i.e. like someone would drive it and say yes or no. What in the road car world, what we did was quite interesting because we broke down that subjectivity into quite discrete driving events, so that we tried to objectify some of that human input a little bit, which again, I don't see so much in racing because we go to a different track every weekend, but just that concept of continually breaking it down, but trying to marry those two things up. How do you feel and what do the numbers say?
That's super interesting what you just said there. I'll tell a quick story that happened to me back in late 90s, I think it was. I was running IndyCars. It was IRL at the time. CART and IRL had just done their split. We were in maybe the second or third year of the IRL, and I worked real closely with the folks at Dallara. I had done their Ferrari 333 back in the day that they had designed for Ferrari, and got to know them, and the team I was working for helped in the development of the first Dallara IRL car. So we were at Indy, and one of the things they were trying to understand, having never raced ovals, high-speed ovals before, were trying to understand why their simulations showed the car should go this speed around turn one at Indy, but the driver would never approach that speed. And they're like, why isn't he getting to the limits of the car? Is our simulation wrong? And we got to the point where it was the feel of the driver. There's the survival instinct, especially at Indy when you're going through that minimum speed as 220 miles an hour in the middle of turn one. And so they started looking at trying to understand that. And we did, now again, this is pretty common now, but back in the 90s, not so much. We put a strain gauge in the steering shaft to measure steering torque. There's no power steering, so we didn't have any hydraulic pressure or electrical torque to measure. So we actually measured the actual twisting torque in the steering shaft. And then we could look at steering position. And then there was a, as you said, in your example, the subjectiveness from the driver, there was a 10 question rate from 1 to 5. How did the steering feel? How did the effort feel? What did you see visually? Did you feel the understeer in your hands or in your eyes or in your body? How do you feel the limit of the car? And then we could look at the data, and if we saw steering torque increasing and angle decreasing, we knew the car was getting what we call here loose or oversteery, because the front was gripping and the driver thought too much and he was taking steering angle out. If we saw steering angle go up and torque go down, we knew it was understeery. He was asking for more turning and he wasn't getting it because the front steering torque was going down. And so then we started to look at the data with his subjective analysis, and we understood why he was doing what he was doing. And that was super important about melding those two, the subjective and the objective, but trying to then understand how we could move his perceived limit closer to the actual limit. So we stopped working on making more grip from a pure vehicle dynamics standpoint, because we could make more grip and the driver never went there. Because something was telling him to stop. This is too fast. I'm going to crash, or I don't have enough grip, or whatever. So we started working on moving the perceived limit of the car up closer to the actual limit, because making the actual limit of the car higher was no benefit.
How did you do that?
There was a lot of things, funny enough, in seating position, in seats themselves, in steering wheel diameter. A smaller diameter made the car feel twitchier. A bigger diameter gave them more feel at the limit. Tubs were actually increased in width around the steering, so we could put a bigger steering wheel in there. Steering rack and pinion ratios all of those things I just described have nothing to do. You could run those in a simulation and it wouldn't show one bit of difference in the grip level the car is making. You don't see it on a shaker rig. You don't see it in a wind tunnel. But those are the things we worked on. Aerodynamics, a little buffeting of the head made the driver just not quite as sure what was going on. So we made sure that the little windscreen on the front of the Indy car got the air over his head. We worked on helmet design and little, you'll see back in the day, the Bell had these flat back helmets and they had vortex generators in the top of the helmets to calm the buffeting down, because it made the driver faster because he could feel the limit better and his perceived limit was higher.
Bought the little plastic aero bits for their helmet and now going, yes.
It's a good thing. That's where that kind of came from. If the driver perceives the limit, that's where he's going to stop, no matter how quick that car is. And a lot of, to go back to the club level stuff and semi-pro stuff, I do Ferrari Challenge, which is a amateur Ferrari 488 single make series worldwide. And it's coaching. They're all beginner drivers with good driver coaches. And that's really the coach's job, because the car is much more capable than these beginning type amateur drivers. So his job is to get the driver to perceive the limit better, both from driver coaching and then from my job as an engineer is different. If I have a pro driver in the car, I'm working on some things that might be different than if I have a more rookie or less experienced driver, because I need him to be able to perceive that limit easier and sooner, so he knows whether he's about ready to crash or he's a long way away from that.
So one of the things that we used to look at the road car thing was the H point, which is your hip in the car, and the position of that when you on the brakes. If your hip goes up, you feel like you're falling through the windscreen. If your hip point goes down, you feel like more part of the car, you feel more confident. The dynamics could be the same. In fact, it's just the positioning of your hip point. If it was having this arc, so it's really fascinating you say about that, is it looking at the seats and having that kind of confidence. Is that the lower the seat, it gives you a better chance maybe of having less of an impact on your H point. What would you do with the amateur driver to try and help them perceive the limit? Are you looking at sort of tire pressures or something? Because you might not have a lot of time between, say, a session. You might do a session, if you're testing, for example, I'm just guessing how your day runs. But if you have a session and they come back and they say, yeah, I'm not feeling so confident, what's your approach there?
It's generally to make the car more numb, less twitchy, less sharp, anything you can do for that to make the car telegraph what it's about to do earlier. I find with a lot of track day people, they all have different capabilities on what they can do with their car. Amateur racers, some of them have formula cars with adjustable shocks and sway bars, and they can easily put springs in it. Others have their daily driver car that they put some shaved down tires on, and they can't really change shocks or springs or things like that quickly. So it's tire pressures, like you said, maybe. And if you can do something that makes the car less sharp, less sensitive, less reactive, then you get some time to understand what it's doing. If you turn into a corner and it just quickly turns in, then you have to react to that real quick, and the less experienced driver can't make those reactions as quick. If you turn into a corner and it leans over a little bit and then starts to do its thing, whatever it's going to do, it gives the driver some time to understand what's happening. And that's where the less experienced driver goes actually quicker with a car, where a very experienced driver might say, it's too soft, it's too rolly, it's too mushy, it moves around too much, because he can react to it and he expects that to happen. So like lower tire pressure, softer springs, softer bars. And a lot of your friends might say, oh, no, softer anti-roll bars, a car will just roll around and go slower. Maybe, but not right now. Maybe you go softer, you understand what the car is doing, you go, okay, it's always going to understeer there because I feel it now. So let's stiffen the bars. And then you come back at it and make the car better. But again, in my just like my Dallara example, there's no sense making the car better if the driver can't use it. So drivers need to get to the point where they know what's going to happen with the car before they start trying to make the car better.
So what's fascinating about what you're saying there is it's quite an interesting point, because you're suggesting that you're adjusting the car to suit the driver. But I feel sometimes that my club racing competitors or colleagues or whatever, we're looking for this one single ideal setup for the car. And what you're saying there is that, yes, there's the setup that might be the ideal setup, but it's not the ideal setup for you right now. And what we need to do to get your lap time quicker is to change the setup in such a way that theoretically it might be less fast, theoretically, or it might be softer in some way. And then we can come, and then you get your confidence up, and then we can start to push it back towards, move it again. So it's almost like there's a kind of, you're treating the setup not as a singular objective optimization, what is the optimal solution? You're using it as a tool to get the most out of your driving.
Exactly right. I use Ferrari Challenge as another example. So almost in America, almost every driver has a driver, professional driver, who's his driver coach on the weekend. I've been working with two really good drivers here as driver coaches, Andy Lally and Nick Janssen, both of them coaching my Ferrari Challenge driver. Each one of those guys will go out with the car and the setup I have on the very first practice of the weekend, drive the car to its limit as a professional, understand it. Then he'll say, and our goal is always to have it too understeery for the pro, because that's safe for my beginning driver. So we get to that point. Yep, it's understeery, great. Then we tell my driver, his name is Mike Watt, we say, Mike, go out. Your job now is to drive it to feel that understeer. It's definitely going to understeer. Drive it as hard as you can to feel it. He goes out and he goes, man, I don't feel it. I don't feel it. We know it's there. He's just not confident enough to drive it to that point yet for some reason. So I might actually make some changes to make the car even more understeery. And then he goes out and he goes, oh yeah, I feel the understeer now. I feel the understeer. So now we know he's getting to the limit of the car. It's not his limit anymore. He's actually got to the limit of the car, which is great, because now he's driving at some level higher than he was before. Now we'll start to take a little of that understeer away. And now, okay, now feel it again, Mike. I feel it now, understeer too much. It's slowing me down. I'll take a little bit more away. And we're approaching, as the weekend goes, hopefully, if things go well, where the pro driver would actually like the car. And that's gotten the driver better along the path as he's chasing that understeer. But if he's not feeling the understeer and it's a massive understeer for the pro, he's not getting to the limit of the car and he's not driving it hard enough. So that's the approach I will take there. And so we've given him actually a worse car, but he goes faster with a worse car. And ultimately, we're all trying to just go faster. I don't care if the car is worse, but the combination of driver and car is better.
That's really fascinating. Because you talked about it's not just the engineering. At some point, you have to win the driver over. How much is Mike involved in that consciously? Or is it something you do on his behalf? How much is he aware of what you're doing there?
I think I've been fortunate to run quite a few amateur club level, I call them semi-pros, because anybody who's paying for a racing program is professional in some way, because they're approaching it in a way where they want to get better. So it's a professional approach. Maybe they don't make their living at it, but they're a semi-pro. It's a professional approach to their hobby. So those guys, they all come at it from a different way. And this is where I think all of these guys can benefit. They've all made enough money to be able to afford their level of racing, which is by definition means they've reached some level of success in their personal life or their business life to be able to afford this. So they have some skills, much like back to the coffee thing. I only know one way to do something from an engineering standpoint, whether it's coffee or anything else. A guy who was accountant probably has some skills that he could apply to racing, and he might understand different parts of that. He might want to be more involved in that. Mike, my Ferrari Challenge driver, is an electrical engineer and has a company that does radar systems and things like that. So he's an engineering mind. So he understands, he likes to understand certain levels of what we're doing. Why, when we stiffen the front anti-roll bar, does it make it more understeery and on one track, but less on another track, depending on the grip level? He likes to understand that to a certain level, not at a pro level, but so it's not hard to get him to buy into it. Here's what we're going to do. Here's why we're going to do it. And the great thing about it is if you understand even a little bit, I've made the front anti-roll bar softer. It should understeer more. Okay, what will that do? How will that change the feel of the car? Well, it'll roll over more, and you might feel it not as crisp in the transition in the bus stop chicane or something. And then they go out and they start to become attuned to that. Oh, I do feel it rolling over more. I don't like that. Or, oh, that's better because I get an idea what's going to happen. So understanding what the change is and having the engineer explain it to the driver, I think is important, because then it makes the driver better at helping the engineer. Because he's, oh, I just don't like it when it rolls over. Then you're at the next race and I say, okay, I'm going to soften the rear anti-roll bar now to get grip off the corner. And they might be like, oh, I don't think I like softer. Remember when you did that two races ago on the front and it rolled over? I don't like that. This is different, and you explain it. But the driver starts to become involved in that. And that's important to be a better driver and to help with your engineer. And if you don't have an engineer, if you're a club racer out there doing it yourself, you are your engineer. You almost have that conversation with yourself. Okay, driver, what'd you feel? I felt this. Okay, engineer, what would you do? I would do this. Oh, but if I do this, it's going to feel like that to the driver. And it's, you're talking to yourself, but you're working through that same process.
Yeah, I've spoken about this before, but as an engineer and a racer myself, I sometimes get a bit over analytical. Yeah, so I struggle to separate the two. And Ross Bentley, he famously says, "Drive stupid." I just stop being the engineer and just be the driver. And I quite like your suggestion there of almost having this person, like you're having a conversation with yourself, but with your two hats, and you can come.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good approach, and it just becomes even on a super professional level where you have paid drivers that I'm working with, high level, highly paid guys, and you're on a big budget supported team. It's the same thing. If the driver isn't bought in or doesn't understand or doesn't agree, he doesn't necessarily have to agree that it's going to work, but agree that he's going to try it and he could see some benefits. It gets back to engineers on a pro level have sometimes different philosophies. A lot of engineers I know will say, I'm not going to tell the driver what I expect the change to do. And I think that's wrong. Okay. Especially at a pro level, they'll say, he'll just give me the feedback that he thinks I want to hear. If you have a driver that's doing that, you have the wrong driver to start out with. You need somebody that will go, that I can say, here's what I think's here's the change. Here's what I think it's going to do to help you in the areas that you said you needed help. Here's the potential downside. Back to our example, it's going to make more front grip, the softer bar, but it's going to be rolly and maybe not transition as good. Let's see what the trade-off is. Is it worth the trade-off? And they can go out and run, and they're attuned to what you've told them the change is going to do. And if you're your own engineer, obviously you know that already. There's, because you made that change for a reason, and you know what the downsides, and then you're attuned to it. Then you can come back and give excellent feedback. Hey, was it softer? Was it rolly and sloppy in the transitions? Yes, because he was tuned into that, because you told him that possibly could be the downside. But he might say, but that's okay, because it was so much better in that long sweeper. I didn't have the understeer. Let's keep it like that. And then so the driver gets bought into the whole thing and part of the process.
Yeah, I think your approach there is really nice because the focus again is on the driver's confidence and trust and belief in not only what you're doing, but everyone's in this together. And the other approach, which is, I've changed this on the car, and yet they haven't. And then they go out and they're trying to trick you out. It just corrodes. I've seen the engineering comedy almost. I got you. It's like, what's the point? What the hell are you talking about here? We're not trying to like big up one each other. It's just, yes, I can improve as a driver. Yes, you can improve as an engineer. Let's just get on with it and do the best we can.
you just brought up a great point. The driver also, if he knows what's going on, there might be times when I say, look, I can help you in this corner with this change by doing this, but it's going to be worse in the brake zones. So if you can modulate the brake better or brake a little lighter early on because it could tend to lock up, we can maybe mitigate the bad effects of that. So you change your style a little bit here and I'll be able to help you over here. I'm headed right after we get done talking toward VIR to go do a test. And one of the tests we're doing with Mike, my Ferrari Challenge driver, is he's going to learn transition from right foot braking to left foot braking.
Whoa.
We think that's a better, he's been right foot braking for his whole racing career, 5-6 years since he started racing. And we think if we can get him to left foot brake, he'll go quicker. But it's going to be that, what is it, 2 steps backwards to go 3 steps forward. It's going to be hard at first and he'll go slower, but we think that'll eventually help. And one of the big aspects of that is his ability to control the platform of the car by left foot braking. And so he'll actually make the car handle better based on how he drives it. And so drivers who understand that they can change the handling of the car, if it's not doing what they want, they can change it with their braking, their accelerating, how they use the steering wheel. And so it's not just the engineer that changes the handling of the car, it's the driver. And there's been points with a right foot braker, for instance, where I will say, look, it's much easier for me if you left foot brake because I can give you a better car overall. If you right foot brake and you're going to continue to do that, I got to run these giant front springs to keep the car from hitting the ground or to keep it from getting too much rake in it or whatever. And you're not going to have the mid-corner grip that another guy would. If you can let me go softer and balance the car with your feet on the brakes and the gas, you'll go quicker. But if you don't want to do that, it's harder for me.
So what's the benefit of left foot braking in your example here?
That you can control the platform of the car.
When you say that, you mean the pitch?
The pitch platform, right. So if you left foot brake, you can come off the throttle, onto the brake, squeeze on the brake, hold the nose of the car, especially if you have almost every even GT car has a pretty powerful splitter nowadays. So you're making some pretty good front downforce. If you right foot brake, the splitter slams on the ground, makes a lot of downforce. You turn in, it turns in sharply. You jump off the brake, the front pops up, and you lose all your front downforce, and it understeers. Okay, exaggeration, but that's the idea. If you're left foot braking, now you can control the height of that splitter with your foot with the brake pressure. So you can keep on the brake, like trail brake into the corner, but still pick up a little throttle. And if it's a little understeery, you can actually give a little more brake. If it's a little oversteery, you can come off the brake a little bit, raise that splitter up, and you can balance the mechanical and aerodynamic aspects of the car with your foot. And so those guys will have an advantage and certainly makes the engineer's job better, easier, and not that's the goal. But if I'm making a setup just to counteract the driver's harsh reaction on the brake into a corner, when he lifts off the gas, the car pitches due to the engine braking, and then he slams on the brake, and then he jumps off the brake because he's got to now get quickly to the throttle. I have to control the pitch of that car mechanically, and that most likely hurts the grip I can make, overall grip I can make.
Okay, yeah. I've got a question for you about our wet setup. So would you do anything to change the car when it's wet? The reasoning behind this is that I hear a lot of paddock folklore about what to do, and it normally involves winding all the clickers off the dampers, softening the anti-roll bar, maybe disconnecting any anti-roll bars that you have, running a slightly different tire pressure than you would normally in the dry. And I don't really know why people do that. So what's your experience of wet setups? Do you do anything different, and how would you approach it?
Okay, so now I'll add my part of folklore or tribal knowledge or whatever. And I'm not going to pretend that this is absolutely right. It works for me, but maybe fortunately, most of my races, the long endurance races I do, even normal IMSA 2 hour and 40 minute races, we rarely get a race where we know it's going to rain the whole time. So if it could be on and off, we're doing Sebring 12 hours, we're doing 24 hours at Daytona, we're doing those kind of races, and it's going to be on and off, then it's easy for me. I won't compromise the dry setup.
Yeah.
I'll put the rain tires on, pump them up 4 PSI from whatever my dry tire pressures are, and send it. That's easy. Now, there are some situations for a challenge. I'm doing some LMP3 sprint races where you might know it's a 45-minute race. It's going to rain the whole time. What do? The first thing is, for me, you're thinking softer. Softer springs, softer bars, as you pretty much described. Actually, I'll back up. And it might not be so much in Europe, but in America, there's this weird thing that happens when it rains during a practice day. Everybody stays in their under their tent and doesn't go out and run. And I don't understand.
In my experience, such as it is, I think people don't like running in the rain necessarily, and so you guarantee to have a bit of free track if it's raining. But I personally still think it's valuable to go out and run in the rain.
I do too. That's what I'm saying. If you're okay, if it's the morning warm up before the 12 hours of Sebring, and you have a $10 million budget, and you have to win this race for your sponsor, and it doesn't look like it's going to rain in the race, but it's raining in the warm-up, yeah, don't go out. It doesn't make sense. But if you're a semi-pro driver who's out doing it for the fun of it and a hobby and trying to learn, man, relish the rain practice. Go out and feel the limit of the car. Feel what it's doing. If you do that, then you can also work on some of your setup. What happens when I disconnect the rear bar in the rain or the front bar? Does this car respond well to it? Does it roll over too much, or does it not make any difference?
The irony there is that because people find a kind of routine, in my experience, they find a sort of a process that they go through when the weather changes, and they don't really change it. And so that, we get to a situation where we're not taking the scientific approach of this is an experiment, let's try lots of different things and find out what we want. We're trying to go the route of just give me the answer, and that's the one optimum solution that we're always going to use. It's the same thing again, you know?
Exactly. You have to learn what works for you. But in general, if you have, okay, it's raining out and you're one of these guys that's saying, great, I'm going to go learn in this practice or this track day, I'm going to go learn. What should I do? I have this thing I call the 51% rule. What I'm about to say works 51% of the time. So 49%, it could be the other way. But in general, 51% of the time, if I didn't know a car and it was raining and I was like, oh, geez, well, now what do I do? And it had a rear anti-roll bar, I would probably disconnect the rear anti-roll bar. I would wind some brake bias to the rear if you have that available. I would, if I had adjustable shocks, I might take some of the low speed bump out, wind that out a little bit, maybe a little rebound too. Depends on the car. If it's a big rolly car to begin with, maybe you don't need to do that. I would pump the tires up 4 PSI. I don't care what tire you have. 4 is a good number. It always seems to work.
Which is always to pump them up to the target hot tire pressure. So whatever.
Not a bad. Yeah, exactly. That's for sure up. So no, that's a good thing. And go send it and try it. If you have a car with wings, here's where I'm going to get in the controversial part of the rain with a car with wings. I always see people, oh, it's raining out. Oh, it's going to be real slippery. I got to pile downforce on it. Put the rear wing up, put the front wing on it, pile downforce on it. And I love that when people do that, because I normally beat those guys in the ring, because I'll either leave the wings or take wing out.
Oh,
I actually learned that in the rain in an IndyCar race that where I was engineering at Road America. So Road America has some pretty good long straightaways, 4 mile track, raining like crazy. I took some wing out. We started, I can't remember, mid pack, and drove it to the top three in 4 laps. I'm willing to say that I'm crazy. A lot of people say that. But if you go around a corner in the rain and you have a lot of downforce in the car in the rain, and you have another car with low downforce, do you think the high downforce car is just going to actually be able to pass the low downforce car in the rain, like on the outside of the corner in the rain, because he has more downforce? I don't think so. The rain has lowered the grip to a level. Take it to its extreme. Let's say we're on an ice skating rink with a high downforce car and a low downforce car. You think the high downforce car is really going to handle that much better on a turn on sheer ice? Not really. The rain is just an intermediate step between a dry track and an ice skating rink. So what I was able to do is pass them all on the straightaways, which is easy in the rain. You just go flat by them because they got too much drag. You get to the corner, you're ahead of them, and they can't pass you. They can't go around the outside of the corner. They don't get enough speed in the middle of the corner to pass you down the next straightaway because you have no downforce on, so you're going fast down the straightaways. And I've always found with the Indy cars, prototypes, something with wings where you can change it, to actually take wing out in the rain, and you'll race better.
That's a nice idea, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, on the straights, it's easier to pass, and you can go past them that way, because the delta from any advantage that they may have in the corners is nullified if they're sat behind you, kind of thing anyway, or it just takes one little slip and they lost that anyway. So yeah, okay, that's a nice one.
Yeah, we talked about getting the buy-in. That may be the most difficult buy-in. If you're gonna do what? You're gonna take downforce? Don't you see the track? It's really slippery. Yeah, just trust me. They're like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not. You've got to be crazy. So it takes the right driver. That's the case where the best scenario is if you're your driver, if you're the driver and the engineer at the same time, then you can try to convince yourself of that and at least go try it. But anyway, I'm not saying it'll work for everybody, but I've had some success with it. So what I can usually do in a case like that is I try to convince the driver that if he's, you got to be crazy. And then I'll be like, okay, let's just leave the wings then. So, okay, at least I know what I had before, I still have now.
Yeah. So the softening thing is quite interesting, because I think you're right. I think there's a 51% answer here. It depends. One of the things that does hold true in all circumstances, a good friend of mine, and she said this to me fairly recently, and it's like, Samir, the tires don't like surprises.
Oh boy, I agree completely.
In the wet, extending what she said there, extending that and saying, well, in the wet, they like surprises less, or you've got less window of grip, or the consequences of losing grip are more than in the dry. You haven't got that sort of, you know, that sliding friction that you would normally have in the dry. So the consequences of getting that bit wrong is more in the dry. So therefore, you know, give yourself a chance by reducing the surprises that the tire can see by making it softer. Going all the way back to what you were saying about making the car drivable, you're taking that energy out, or the ability for the driver to add to give yourself a minute.
I agree. It's, to me, I look at from a data standpoint and from just a feel standpoint and a general concept is how hard and how quickly you load the tire. And so if it's really slippery, and everything we're saying about the rain is the same direction you would do if you got to a low grip track. We have a couple of tracks. Laguna Seca is worn out, needs a repave. I hope they never repave it, because it has its own character. But it's super low grip. So you're going to do the same types of things toward a rain setup when you go to Laguna Seca than you would at Watkins Glen. They just repaved a couple years ago, probably the grippiest track in all North America. You do a different thing. So you have those same tendencies. And what you need to do is load the tire more gently over a longer period of time. Because if you load it instantly, it just takes off. It can't grip. And so in the rain, you need to load it gently over a long period of time. How do you do that? Softer is one thing. Driver can have a lot of effect on that, how he loads the tire, how quickly he turns the steering wheel. And so I like to take things when I'm trying to figure that out, when you're like, oh, okay, so now what did he say? What's when it's grippy and not grippy? Take it to its extreme. I use this example of think if the track is grippier and you're thinking, what should I do? Think what you would do if your tires were made out of one side of Velcro and the track was made out of the other side of Velcro and it just stuck like crazy. What would you do? Or if it's real slippery, think, what would you do if you suddenly, the racetrack was suddenly frozen over ice on slick tires? What would you do? If it was ice, you don't want to shock load that tire and turn the steering wheel real hard and put the brakes on. It'll just take off sliding. Think about what you do when you walk on an ice skating rink with your shoes. You're very gentle. You put your foot down. You wait for it to pick up some grip. And you don't go running and cutting like a football player. You'll fall down. Cars. So that kind of gives you a, I can't tell you with your BMW M3 on this Pirelli tire that you should take two clicks of rear rebound out when it rains. I don't know. But if you have a concept and understanding of the direction, you can make that choice yourself by taking it to its extreme and thinking about what you would do in each one of those extremes that helps you pick a direction.
Yeah, that's a really good thought. And that's something that's really applicable for anyone listening as well. Have you got any final thoughts for people listening? What are the virtues of coffee where we started? I just love that. But then, final thoughts have you got for people listening? You know, you might be thinking, right, okay, how can I maybe apply some of this stuff? Where should I start? Maybe I am engineers themselves, or maybe I've got, you know, friends or whatever who are helping me run the car. How can we do something different, having that you've seen work in a professional world that you don't often see in a club world that you think, you know what, guys, you should just have a look at that?
Yeah, I would say the one thing I see from semi-pro teams, even some of the pro teams, but is the free things that a lot of the people who don't have a budget, whether it's a lower budget pro team all the way down to the guy that's going to his first track day. There's a lot of free things out there that you don't have to have a budget for. Note taking. I made this change to the car on this day. It was this temperature and it felt like this. Maybe I don't even have a data system. So I don't even really have data, but it felt like it understeered more, or it felt like it was moving around more. I did like that. I didn't like that.
Taking that kind of driver feedback?
I think it worked. It depends on the driver. Some drivers like to have a track map and they write notes on the track map. Some people like to have it questions asked. If you have a buddy or you have an engineer who's talking to you, they ask questions and then the engineer writes them down. Whatever, the most important thing is that you get the information somehow in whichever way works best for you and your team. Not that you are regimented in some way that works best for me or some other pro engineer, because then it becomes a chore and it's like, oh, I got to write this down this way and I don't really understand why I'm doing this. Take the notes that mean something to you that you can refer back to, and you'll start to build your database of understanding of the car. That's absolutely free. You don't have to have a $10 million budget to do that. It's the same thing with planning ahead before the weekend. So many people, it's expensive to go run your car on a racetrack. You have to pay for the weekend, transport there, tires, fuel, your time away from home and family. It's expensive. You need to want to make every second that you're at the racetrack count. And so plan ahead. Okay, I have a practice from 8 to 8:30, and I've never run this tire before. What am I going to do? And write down. It doesn't have to be a 20-page Excel spreadsheet. It can be some notes on a piece of paper, but practice one. I'm going to go out on this pressure. I'm going to run three laps to get the tires up to temperature. I'm going to come in the pits and have my buddy bleed him down to the hot pressures I think are good. Then I'm going to go out and run four hard laps. And then I'm going to come in and write down how I thought it handled. In the second session, I'm going to do this and this. And it'll change during the weekend, but at least go in with a plan. So you don't just go out and drive some laps and come in, friend, now what do we do? I don't know. There's 5 minutes left. Oh, I better go run a lap. And you just, and again, that's free. You don't have to have a budget to do that. And you can get leaps and bounds of people that don't have a plan and don't write down what they're doing. And so to me, that's those are the things that I see club racers missing an opportunity, and they don't have to have a budget. A lot of people like to look at it. Oh, that guy's got better tires. He can afford two new sets a weekend. I can only afford one. He's going to beat me all the time. Yeah, don't use that as an excuse. Come up with, do the free things that you can afford better than that guy, and you might overcome that extra set of tires that he has that you can't afford.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's great advice. The planning ahead is easy, isn't it, if you think about it. So I know what I'm going to do is just one-liners, isn't it? I'll try this. Right. Even if you don't necessarily stick to it, or something happens, or at least you've gone through that process of going, well, I'm trying to get a bit more organized. And if I do that, then I'm going to know something more. That's something that's going to help me in the future.
My test plans always start out the first session plan is pretty good all the time. The second session plan, it deviates a little. The third one is a little more. By the time I get to the qualifying session, it probably doesn't look like what I wrote down in my plan. But I have some options. If this happens, I'm going to try this. Wow. This track's really slippery, so I'm going to need this and this ready probably. And if this happens, I might do this. And, oh, I don't have those springs. I got to go borrow those from a buddy or something because I'm probably going to need those. If you just do a little thinking and a little bit of planning, you'll be prepared for anything that crops up, or better prepared than the next guy. And that's all we're trying to do. We just beat the next guy.
Absolutely. And I think that's all you need to do, isn't it? I mean, Jackie Stewart used to say, you know, I drive as slow as I can to win. You know, you do the minimum engineering or minimum whatever you need to do to win.
Exactly. And then my last piece of advice I always say is just, I've been fortunate enough to be in racing since I was 5 years old, and I'm 63 now and been making a living at it for 45 years. And it's a great way to make a living. Sometimes it gets a little bit intense with the team you're on, or the sponsorship pressures, or the expectations. And I always love going back. Like this Ferrari Challenge is fantastic for me because it brings me back to why we went racing in the first place, to have fun. My driver, Mike, is not doing this because he's going to make it his profession. He has a big company that he runs and he does just fine doing that. He does it because he enjoys it, and he would rather do that than, I don't know what, sail a boat, play golf, whatever. And it needs to be fun. Make it fun, make it enjoyable. And it's a great sport. And if you're a person who wants to make it a career, you can make it a career. That's what I did. I started out racing go-karts when I was 5 years old. I didn't even know you could have a career in racing. I didn't even know you had to have a job. I was a five-year-old. What did I know? But I turned it into a career. But it doesn't have to be a career, and it better not ever, if you're paying for it yourself, it better never be a job where you have to do it, because then you got something backwards.
You make a really good point. A lot of the stuff that we're talking about, the planning, the feedback, looking at day, raising sponsorship, for some people, I think they do find it a chore. And mm-hmm. If it becomes a chore, just don't do it. But it's not going to stop me from saying, and if you do want to get better, this is a way that could work for you. Remember, it's about having fun.
Right. And some of the fun for a lot of people is the challenge of driving. Some of it's the challenge of making the car better. I actually drove for a long time. And about the time I was 17 or 18, I actually, and this may be just because I wasn't a good enough driver, so I'm using this as an excuse. But I actually got more interested in making the car go faster. I remember being underneath my Triumph Spitfire, changing the anti-roll bar position before a practice session at a SCCA, which is the American Club Racing Series. Underneath there, changing my anti-roll bar, and the loudspeaker came on. I was in a class called G Production and said, okay, G Production to the grid. I'm like, oh, man, I wish there was somebody else that could drive this. They could be putting their helmet on so I can finish this anti-roll bar change, because I really want to see what this is going to do. And at that point, it dawned on me that maybe I like the engineering part better than the driving part. Now, if I had some skills as driving, maybe it would have changed my opinion. But so you can move however you want in racing, but it better be fun, because if it's not fun, you'll never want to go any further.
That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been genuinely really fascinating to have you on the show, and I hope people have really enjoyed listening to what you're saying. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun to talk racing. I've always said it's the next best thing to actually doing it. So maybe sometime you and I, Samir, will be at the track at the same time and we can go racing together. Thank you.
What an absolute honor to have Jeff on the show. I really hope you found that as fascinating as I did. There's so many insights there on the process that we go through, the philosophy about matching the car to the driver. But overall, I hope you think about his way of going racing. For a man with such experience to be so humble about how he would approach something is the real lesson here for me. I hope you found the same. See you next time.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.